A nationwide strike is about to shut down steel production in the middle of a war. The president orders the mills seized, so the weapons keep coming. Congress never authorized it. Does he have the power? No. That is the steel seizure case, Youngstown, and the president lost. But the lasting part was not the result. It was Justice Jackson's concurrence, which sorts every presidential action into one of three zones, depending on what Congress has said. The president never acts in a vacuum. His power rises or falls with Congress's position. So get in the habit of asking one question first. Is he acting with Congress's blessing, in its silence, or against its wishes? That single question unlocks nearly everything in this episode. Here is the root. First, the three zones, the tool you open every question with. Then Commander-in-Chief, where the President commands and Congress declares and funds. Then Appointments, who may pick the people who run the government. Then Removal, which the Supreme Court rewrote in 2026. And finally, Agencies, which write rules, enforce them, and judge them, all at once. Zone 1. Maximum. Congress has authorized the action, expressly or impliedly. The president holds his own authority, plus everything Congress can delegate, and the action gets the strongest presumption of validity. It is upheld unless the federal government as a whole lacks the power. Zone 2. The Twilight Zone. Congress is silent, neither granting nor denying. So the president relies on his own independent powers alone. Outcomes here are uncertain and turn on history, practice, and circumstance. Zone 3. The lowest ebb. Congress has forbidden the action. Now the president has only his own constitutional powers, minus whatever Congress controls. And he loses unless the power is exclusively his. Try it. Congress passes a statute expressly barring the use of any federal funds to station U.S. ground troops in Colombia. The president orders a deployment anyway and pays for it out of other accounts. Which zone? Zone 3, lowest ebb. His order survives only if stationing those troops is a power the Constitution commits to him exclusively, beyond Congress's reach. That is hard to argue while Congress is exercising its own war and spending powers. Now flip one fact. Suppose Congress had instead passed a resolution authorizing force in Colombia. Same deployment, now Zone 1, and the president is at his strongest. The deployment did not change. Congress's position did. Which brings us to command. Article 2 makes the president commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. That is a power of command, directing troops, tactics, and operations. It is not a blank check. The framers split the war power deliberately. Congress alone declares war, raises and supports armies, provides and maintains a navy, makes the rules governing the military, and holds the purse. So the president runs the operation, and Congress controls the on-off switch and the money. He may repel sudden attacks and deploy forces to protect the nation without waiting for a declaration. What he cannot do is start or sustain a war Congress refuses to authorize or pay for. Congress tried to police that gap with the War Powers Resolution, a 1973 statute. The president must notify Congress within 48 hours of introducing forces into hostilities. He must withdraw them within 60 days, plus a 30-day wind-down, unless Congress declares war or specifically authorizes the deployment. Two things to know. It is a statute, not a constitutional rule, and its ultimate constitutionality is unsettled. Command authority is broad, but it does not switch off the Constitution. A citizen detained as an enemy combatant still gets due process. Notice of the factual basis and a meaningful chance to rebut it before a neutral decision-maker. Habeas corpus reaches detainees held where the United States has long-term control, and the president cannot create military commissions on his own say-so. Congress has to authorize them. And domestically? A president who seizes private businesses on grounds of wartime necessity, against Congress's wishes, is at his lowest ebb and usually loses. Which is where we came in. The steel mills. Appointments next. The Constitution sorts federal personnel into three buckets. Principal officers, the most senior. Cabinet secretaries, agency heads, ambassadors, federal judges. Inferior officers, who exercise real authority but under someone else's supervision. And employees, who wield no significant authority of their own and fall outside the clause entirely. The rules follow the rank. Principal officers must be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. No shortcut exists. For inferior officers, Congress chooses the path. It may require Senate confirmation or vest the appointment in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. How do you tell them apart? Supervision. An inferior officer is directed and supervised by a principal officer, the president appointed with Senate consent. If an official issues final decisions that no principal officer may review, that unreviewable power looks principal, and appointing them as a mere inferior officer violates the clause. And Congress may never appoint executive officers itself. The recess power is narrow, too. The president may temporarily fill vacancies during a genuine Senate recess, but the break has to be long enough to count. The court has treated breaks shorter than about 10 days as presumptively insufficient, and brief pro forma sessions do not qualify. Now, removal. And this is where the ground moved. If the president is responsible for faithfully executing the laws, he has to control the people who execute them. And control ultimately means the power to fire. The current baseline. A subordinate who exercises the president's executive power is removable at will, and Congress cannot condition that removal on cause. To see why that matters, you need the exception it replaced. In 1935, in Humphrey's executor, the court let Congress protect the multi-member heads of independent agencies, the FTC being the model, from removal except for cause: inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. The theory was that such bodies exercised quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial functions rather than purely executive ones. Over the last 15 years, the court narrowed it steadily. It struck down two layers of four-cause protection stacked on each other. Then came CELA law. A single director heading a powerful agency like the CFPB cannot be shielded by four-cause removal. Concentrating executive power in one unaccountable person is incompatible with presidential control. And in 2026, the court finished the job and overruled Humphrey's executor entirely. So here is the current picture. The president may remove at will any officer who exercises executive power on his behalf, including the heads and members of formerly independent agencies. If a question hands you a statute saying commissioners are removable only for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance, treat that clause as constitutionally suspect. It is not a shield. There is an exception, so try this one. Congress creates a small federal body whose only job is to study workplace safety data and publish non-binding recommendations. It holds no hearings, brings no enforcement actions, issues no binding rules, and adjudicates nothing. Its members have four-cause protection. Does that protection hold? Yes. The at-will rule reaches officers who exercise executive power, and this body exercises none, so it falls outside the rule entirely. Once an official enforces, prosecutes, makes binding rules, or adjudicates, the protection is gone. The question is always whether the official executes the law. Two more pieces. The Federal Reserve is treated as a unique, historically rooted exception. In a 2026 companion case, the court left a sitting Fed governor in office and stressed the Fed's special status. But it ruled narrowly. The president had not given her the required pre-removal process, and the court did not resolve the constitutional question. Treat the Fed as sui generis, and Congress may never remove an executive officer itself. Its only tool is impeachment. Now, agencies, where the worry is that one body wears three hats at once, it enforces like an executive, charging and fining. It makes binding rules like a legislature, and it decides disputes like a court. Each hat triggers its own limit. Enforcement means presidential control. Rulemaking means a valid delegation. Adjudication means due process, juries, and appointments. Take rulemaking. Congress cannot do everything itself, so it delegates. And the non-delegation doctrine asks how much it may hand off. The test is forgiving. A delegation is valid so long as Congress lays down an intelligible principle, a general policy, and boundaries to confine the agency's discretion. The court has not struck a federal statute for excessive delegation since 1935, and in 2025, it reaffirmed the test and refused to toughen it. Test that. Congress creates an air quality board and directs it to set emission limits at the levels requisite to protect public health, allowing an adequate margin of safety. A plant owner says that is an unconstitutional delegation of lawmaking. Is it? No. Requisite to protect public health, with an adequate margin of safety, is an intelligible principle. It states the goal, marks the boundaries, and leaves the agency to fill in technical detail. Change the statute to say only that the board shall regulate air as it sees fit, and now it is vulnerable, because there is no guiding standard at all. Because non-delegation rarely bites, the real modern limit is the major questions doctrine. When an agency claims power to decide a question of vast economic and political significance, courts will not assume Congress buried that authority in a vague or ancillary provision. The agency must point to clear congressional authorization. That is how the court struck down an attempt to reshape the national energy sector through an old pollution statute. It did the same to a mass student loan cancellation program resting on a thin statutory hook. Third hat, judging. Two limits. Procedural due process applies when an agency proceeding threatens a protected liberty or property interest, like terminating welfare or disability benefits, notice, and a meaningful chance to be heard before a neutral decision maker. And in 2024, the court drew a hard line. When the government seeks civil penalties for conduct resembling a traditional common law claim, their securities fraud, the defendant gets a jury in an Article III court. The dividing line is the public rights exception. Agencies may still adjudicate matters historically handled by the executive or legislature. Immigration, customs, and tariffs. The grant of public benefits. Claims that look like private common law suits for legal remedies belong in court before a jury. And agency adjudicators who wield significant authority are themselves officers who must be properly appointed. Two structural rules close this out. Courts no longer defer to an agency's reading of an ambiguous statute. The court's 2024 decision ending Chevron deference directs judges to use their own independent judgment. The agency's view may persuade, but it does not bind. And Congress may not use a legislative veto, a one- or two-house resolution overturning an agency action, because any exercise of legislative power needs both houses and presentment. To rein in an agency, Congress must pass a real statute or use the budget. A word on authorities. This episode named three cases, and it described the two 2026 decisions that rewrote this area by what they held rather than by name. That is deliberate. Next-gen questions hand you a scenario, often with the statute attached, and ask what the rule produces. They will not ask you for case names, least of all brand new ones. If you keep only three names, keep these. The Steele seizure case, Youngstown, for Jackson's three zones, which is your opening move on any presidential power question. Humphrey's executor, for the independent agency exception that stood from 1935 until 2026. And Selah Law, for the single powerful director who could never be shielded. Now the traps. One, and it is the big one. Applying Humphrey's executor as though Congress may still protect independent agency heads with for-cause removal. It was overruled in 2026. The president may fire them at will. Fed governors excepted. Two, do not extend the Federal Reserve carve-out to ordinary agencies. It is unique. 3. Do not think a broad delegation is automatically unconstitutional. The intelligible principle test is easily met. The real limit is the major questions doctrine, which demands clear authorization only for enormous assertions of power. 4. Do not assume an agency may always adjudicate in-house. If the government seeks civil penalties for a claim that looks like a common law action, the Seventh Amendment may require a jury. 5. Do not confuse the war powers. The president commands, but only Congress declares war and funds it. So a president acting against a congressional funding bar is at his lowest ebb. 6. Congress cannot appoint or directly remove executive officers. It can structure offices, and it can impeach. 7. Courts no longer defer to agency statutory interpretations. Time for the quick check. This one comes straight from the Bargo Question Bank. You are reviewing the charter of a 5-member federal communications regulator. Its members enforce federal law, issue binding licensing rules, and adjudicate alleged violations. The charter gives them fixed 6-year terms and says they are removable by the president only for good cause shown. A client who expects to clash with the agency asks how much shelter that for-cause language actually provides. What is your best advice? Option 1. The clause is fully enforceable, so the president cannot remove a member without proving good cause. Option 2. The clause is valid because multi-member commissions are always protected from removal. Option 3. The clause is constitutionally suspect and likely unenforceable against removal of these officers. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 3. These members wield executive power. They enforce, they make rules, they adjudicate. So the president may remove them at will, and the for-cause clause is an unconstitutional restraint a court will likely refuse to enforce. Option 1 states the discarded rule, and it is the answer most study aids printed before 2026 still give. Option 2 leans on the multi-member independent structure, and that reasoning was overruled. The clause is a weak read against a determined president, not a guarantee of tenure. If option 1 felt right, that is exactly the stale rule the examiners are hunting for. There are 30-plus more questions on this topic alone. 5 things to take away. 1. Locate Congress first. Zone 1 with authorization. Zone 2 in silence. Zone 3 against its will. And in Zone 3, the president wins only if the power is exclusively his. 2. Principal officers need presidential nomination and Senate confirmation. Inferior officers may be appointed by the president alone, a court, or a department head. 3. The president may now remove at will any officer who exercises executive power, and a for-cause clause over such officers is constitutionally suspect. The exceptions are a body with no executive power and the Federal Reserve. 4. Delegation needs only an intelligible principle. A major question needs clear authorization. 5. Agencies wear three hats, each with its own limit, which brings us back to the steel mills. The president lost because Congress had spoken and the power was not exclusively his. Locate Congress, name the zone, and you will be right far more often than not. Next time, federalism and preemption. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.